Chapter 11. You'll know him by his fruit. Therefore, by their fruits you will know them. Matthew chapter 7, verse 16. In 1957, the black sociologist E. Franklin Frazer published a book about the black middle class, The Black Bourgeoisie. In it, he explored the notion that business success and capitalism could ever produce racial equality in America. It's not an unfamiliar argument. Black people, like other groups on society's margins, have tried to do what white America has demanded of them to be accepted, only to realize that it's futile. The black bourgeoisie, who have striven to mold themselves in the image of the white man, have not been able to escape from the mark of racial inferiority, Frazer wrote. And it's true. So the reason I fled Oklahoma for Harvard and Oxford, stocking up on every measure of the bourgeoisie fervor I could. But I still get pulled over by the police seemingly wherever I drive. I still get told that I'm less than by society. And I still inspire white women to clutch their purses closer when I walk by. Jake Simmons and his son, Jake Simmons Jr., prosperous though they were, didn't try to meet some bar of respectability. Their goal was to plant roots in a place that for a time seemed outside the reaches of white supremacy. Perhaps the best way to tell the story of Jake Simmons Jr. is to start where his story ends. Jonathan Greenberg, who was a business writer for Forbes, wrote a book about him and recounted that on the day Jake Jr. died in 1981 in his hometown of Muskogee, the city hall and courts closed in his honor. Legendary Oklahoma Democratic Governor George Nye made his way to Muskogee to eulogize Jake Jr., and hundreds of others came from as far away as Ghana to pay their respects at War Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Church, right off Denison Street in downtown Muskogee. Jake Jr. had spent years serving on its board and channeled much of his philanthropy through the church and its seminary, Shorter College. Why would a black man in Oklahoma, whom you've likely never heard of, garner such a diverse crowd at his funeral? Why would Jake Simmons Jr. be the man whom Muskogee, a town whose population at the time was less than 11% black, honored by closing its schools and city government buildings on the day of his funeral? The answer is simple. Jake Simmons Jr. was a black man who was born on a springboard that came with his citizenship in the Creek Nation. His citizenship gave him land, and that land gave him a glimpse of what it takes to make it in America. In 1982, Jonathan Greenberg was given an assignment whose initial mandate came straight from the top: compile a ranking of the wealthiest people in America, the first ever Forbes 400. Malcolm Forbes, the publisher of the magazine, had told Greenberg's editor, Jim Michaels, not just to compile the list from government data, but to try to dig into information about people's private holdings and equities. Greenberg abandoned the northeast orbit of business journalism anchored by Forbes to, as described in a retelling of the list's birth in an article written by Chase Peterson Withorn, hit Dallas, Houston, and Midland in search of America's greatest oil fortunes, travel from the old money Boston to the nascent Silicon Valley tech scene, and make stops in Atlanta, Detroit, Chicago, Tulsa, and dozens of other cities. In his travels, Greenberg stops in Oklahoma to find high net worth individuals for the list without tipping them off to the magazine's intent. Greenberg met with Taft Welch, chairman of the board of the Western National Bank in Oklahoma, to find people in Oklahoma who might be candidates for the list of the 400 richest Americans. Before Greenberg could go into detail, Welch scolded him, saying, "You're missing Jake Simmons from Muskogee, the colored fellow who put Phillips into Africa. He's a born raider worth more than any of the names you got here." Though Jake Jr.'s net worth couldn't be calculated by Greenberg or the Forbes team, it was clear he was a man to pay attention to. In 1890, Robert Porter and Carol Wright administered a Department of the Interior census of the Five Nations. "Negro Indians, especially in the Creek Nation, can be found in abundance," they wrote. They commented on the vibrancy of the Five Nations, but especially focused on the uniqueness of the Creek Nation. "The Creek Nation is an alert and active one," they wrote, "which is largely due to the Negro element, which fairly controls it. the Negroes are among the most earnest workers in the Five Tribes. The Creek Nation affords the best example of Negro progress. The principal chief, virtually a Negro, comes of a famous family in Creek annals, and who famous Creek contemporary poet Alex Posey accused of looking more Negro than white. Porter and Wright didn't just imagine this world. They witnessed this Black success in the Creek Nation with their own eyes. They saw Blacks like Jake Simmons Sr. embody Black accomplishment and progress. Jake Simmons' economic and business successes were real, and they were built on the foundation of Creek citizenship. And it was Creek citizenship that made Porter and Wright describe these Black Creeks with the loaded term virtually Negroes. These virtual Negroes were chronicled in the Topeka Plain Dealer in 1910. It read, "A large percentage of the Negro population on the eastern side of the state had rich allotments from their Indian citizenship." Jake Jr. grew up at the height of this Black abundance. His father was one of the most successful Black ranchers of the time and dreamed that his children, especially his sons, would continue in his tradition of ranching. His father had established his dominance in ranching on the outer borders of Haskell, Oklahoma, near Muskogee. When Jake Jr. was a child, the Muskogee City Council had Black counselors, a concept unheard of in a town that wasn't explicitly an all-Black town. Its Blackness and its Creekness created opportunities when so many other Black Americans had limited chances for success. In the words of the Black editor of the Muskogee Scimitar, William Twine, "The Indian Territory is the last stand the Negro of America can make as a pioneer, and we propose to let it go down in history that the stand was made here, and that the loyal members of the race stood as a stone wall for justice and right, and at all times were loyal to their race, their country, and their God. We will show to the world that the Negro pioneers of the West are breaking the way for posterity to follow, and that in the early years of the 20th century, to live under the wings of the American Eagle and under the shining folds of the Star-Spangled Banner will live in peace." To some extent, the town of Muskogee contained vibrant Black life. The Simmons family would go into town to buy shoes, clothes, and odds and ends, often from Black shop owners. They would take their horses to compete at county fairs. They'd get together with other Black kids, often of other Black Creeks, who lived on their Black-owned plots to enjoy their Black abundance on their own Black terms. At this time, early in the 20th century, Black life on the eastern side of Indian Territory was inextricably tied to that of the Creek Nation. Nearly 37% of the Creek Nation was made up of Black people, living on more than 1 million acres. The representation of Black Creeks in terms of land was far more pronounced than that of Blacks in other nations, who had altogether 1 million acres. Land ownership, which had been a dream of Edward McCabe, was a reality for Jake Simmons and his children. As Greenberg wrote in Forbes, "Blacks in the Creek Nation were born lucky. They received not just 40 acres, but a 160-acre freehold. This may not have transformed the entire world, but it certainly altered the world of Jake Jr.'s youth." Why? Because Jake was born before the March 4th, 1907 cutoff, he was entitled to 160 acres of land specifically because he was Creek. The promise of 40 acres and a mule was left unfulfilled for millions of Black families. But for Jake, thanks to his forebears' negotiating skills, it was his birthright. And with land ownership came the means of controlling production. No wonder Booker T. Washington found the success and wealth of the Simmons family attractive enough to recruit young Jake to attend the Tuskegee Institute. In contrast, white people who came to Oklahoma for a chance to take the land that belonged to Blacks and Native Americans had different ideas. They'd come from states where they were used to Blacks taking a backseat to white lives and livelihood. They were used to the entitlement that came from their own skin color. But once they entered the eastern part of Oklahoma, they had to adjust to the anomaly of successful Black folk. For Black Creeks, living presented a problem for white supremacists. In addition to barring Blacks from traveling in the same train cars as whites, Haskell and his legislative peers went further. they passed anti-miscegenation laws preventing blacks from marrying Native Americans, though whites could continue marrying into Native American families. By 1910, Democrats in Congress ripped from blacks, Creek or not, the right to vote by grandfathering an amendment to the Constitution that limited voting eligibility to those who were allowed to vote before January 1, 1866, a date that barred virtually every black man in America. And if you were lucky enough to be eligible to vote as a black person, you'd have to pass a literacy test, which no white voter was subjected to. In the early 20th century, Oklahoma was booming. Between 1907 and 1930, Oklahoma vied with California for the title of the top oil-producing state. When Jake Simmons Jr. was 10, his father asked all of his sons what they wanted to be when they grew up. Jake's brothers aspired to be farmers, ranchers, and cowboys. Jake Jr. wanted to be an oilman. It was a dream he'd fulfill. 21 miles from Jake Jr.'s house lived a woman named Ida Glenn. Jake Jr. would have heard about Ida Glenn number one. In Tulsa County, there was a small plot of land that was allotted to Robert and Ida Glenn, two Black Creek citizens. It sat for years without anyone understanding what was beneath it. But two enterprising wildcatters, aspiring oilmen, obtained a lease on the allotment provided to Mrs. Glenn. By 1904, Ida and her husband received a measly $45, or $1,300 today, to lease the land long enough to drill for oil on it. Ida and Robert retained 1/8 of the proceeds from whatever oil would be found. And find oil, the oil tycoons did. For years, 75 to 85 barrels of good black gold were drilled from a well on that land every day. Though the oil field was eventually abandoned in the 1960s, over the course of its life, it produced 340 million barrels of oil. The town that started with 12 families, the Black Creek family of the Glens being among them, soon jumped in population and was renamed Glenpool after this enterprising black couple. Black Oklahomans, especially Black Creek landowners, were part of a new type of business people, landowners who became oilmen. Jake Jr. wanted to be one of those Black Oklahomans. While he knew at age 10 that life on the ranch was not for him, Jake Jr. did work on his father's land. He fed cows, cleaned out dung, and more. Eventually, he took Booker T. Washington's offer to study at the Tuskegee Institute. Jake would start a year younger than the average student, spend 5 years in Tuskegee, Alabama, graduate, and then migrate north to work in a Ford plant. Before he could build a life in Detroit, however, opportunities sprang from the ground in the form of oil on land he owned. Jake Sr. contacted his son to tell him that his land had oil under it. His Creek identity, fought for and protected for generations by his forebears, made his dream of becoming an oilman a reality. After he returned to Oklahoma, Jake Jr. married Eva Flowers, whose parents were also Creek and who also owned Creek land for which they received oil royalties. He didn't need to live on his land to administer it, but he was light on cash. So instead of gambling what little money he had to drill for more oil, Jake Jr. became a broker. Many people, Black Creeks and non-Black Creeks, worked with Jake Jr. to broker deals between wildcatters. He started first with his parents' land. He'd get royalties from the renters and companies who drilled oil on the land, and his family and his eventual clients would collect revenue on 1/8 of the oil found. He didn't stop there. He created a real estate company to help identify and prospect land, negotiate land deals, offer options on lands for mineral rights, and at times estimate and sell farmland. He mastered swap options, ownership titles, deeds, and nearly every aspect of the transaction process. He became so adept that he was able to strike deals with wealthy white oilmen who were willing to overlook the color of his skin for the money that Jake Jr. would make them. To the white oilmen of the time, greed had no race. In 1929, the Great Depression hit. But it hit more lightly for Jake Jr. precisely because he wasn't like others in America who faced economic ruin. Capital dried up quickly, and so did the business of drilling, which depended on capital. As such, the oil lease business that Jake Jr. used to build his rapid wealth was reduced to almost nothing. But because the Simmons land and that of his wife was owned outright, and the family kept farm animals, Jake Jr. and his family avoided the twin scourges of poverty and hunger that plagued millions of others. He had more than enough land to sell to continue generating revenue. But the benefits of his Creek identity didn't stop there. He sold land to wealthy Black Texans, just as many Black Texans were experiencing racial terror in Texas. He'd show them all the Black towns and the highly concentrated parts of Black Muskogee, where he owned significant property. He lured them by telling them of the well-to-do Black families who owned shops and land as far as the eye could see. And he could speak of the prosperous lives of Black families who created for themselves enclaves just slightly more distant from the haunt of racism than parts of Texas. As a Black man, Jake was able to attract the attention of Black Texans who distrusted white brokers. And as a Creek man, he could leverage his identity's deep roots in the land. He was doubly blessed, the blessing and fortune unearned by him, but warranted by birthright. These opportunities carried him and his family through the Great Depression. But to prosper, Jake Jr. had to go farther, striking deals not just in Oklahoma, but throughout East Texas, which at that time was a hotbed of racial violence. At the time, Frank Phillips, founder of what is now ConocoPhillips, made some of his first big deals working in Indian Territory with the Osage Nation. So Jake Jr. leveraged his Blackness and his Creek identity to work with Phillips as his broker, and broker deals and sell oil leases he did. He went on to work with the founders of Sinclair Oil, Skelly Oil, Spartan Aircraft Company, as well as Texaco and other companies. Often they would front Jake the money to acquire large plots of land that he would then sell and lease to others. While Creekland was his home base, he expanded across Oklahoma, East Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Kansas. With his business prowess and a claim to the land that predated Oklahoma becoming a state, Jake Jr. was, more than most Black people, able to have a voice on topics and issues and speak his mind. He advised governors on juvenile detention centers and state mental health facilities reserved for Black people. He chaired the Oklahoma chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He helped finance constitutional challenges to the segregation practice in the state and sued the district attorney of Muskogee, the town's mayor, and the State Board of Education for unfairly limiting educational benefits for Black children. And for his efforts, he earned not only a date in the U.S. Supreme Court for a case that bore his family name, Simmons versus Muskogee Board of Education, but also a nickname, Radical Troublemaker. Though his reputation among local and state political leaders soured, no one could deny Jake Jr. his seat at the table, because the table was on his people's land. Though Simmons versus Muskogee Board of Education was dismissed by the court, it canonized Jake Jr. as a fixture of Black liberation in Oklahoma. His prowess extended beyond the United States. He brokered oil deals in Ghana, Nigeria, and Liberia. But his greatest achievements weren't medals from African heads of state or successful negotiations with government leaders. His greatest achievement was his legacy. Leadership runs in the family. As his niece Johnny May put it, "We got big government leaders, oilmen, teachers, postmasters, you name it, we got them all." As a child, I never considered what it would look like if Black folks had a leg up from birth, one that predated a white person giving them any support. Until I learned about Jake Simmons Jr. and the rest of the Simmons family, I never considered what it meant to be part of a family in which the sacrifices your ancestors made paid dividends for you. My reading of American history told me that Black people went from slavery to Jim Crow to another kind of slavery, one behind bars thanks to government policies like the war on drugs. Jake Simmons Jr. and his life provided the answer to the question I've asked myself for too long. What if Black people's assertion of mattering didn't depend on what society, or more precisely, white people had to say? What would it look like for the children of trailblazing Black people not shackled by slavery, Jim Crow, the war on drugs, and even our lives today. Jake's four children had that sense of self. Don Simmons went on to run his father's company, the Simmons Royalty Company, and continued to run the company late into his life. Kenneth attended Harvard and taught for decades at Berkeley. Blanche pursued a career in social work throughout the Southwest. And his namesake, Jake Simmons III, eventually joined the Kennedy administration and would become an undersecretary of the Interior Department during the first Reagan administration and a member of the Interstate Commerce Commission in the 1980s and 90s. The Simmons family isn't necessarily the blueprint for what all Black success should look like, but by examining their start, which was accelerated by full citizenship in the Creek Nation, we can imagine ways that Black life could flourish in America if they received such support. I didn't have to go far to see what Black success looked like. I had to look just a few miles south of my hometown to capture a glimpse of the story of a Black family named Simmons, whose citizenship was Creek and who had an ancestor known as Cow Tom. 2 years before Jake Jr.'s funeral in 1979, his and his family's claim to citizenship in the Creek Nation came to an end, upending his family's long-standing residence in a nation that crafted citizenship and identity that his family had helped forge. Chapter 12. Johnny May Stopped Getting Mail. It's Just Who I Was, Johnny May Austin. Plastered across the June 15, 1997 edition of the Tulsa World was the headline, Creek Nation to Honor Longtime Chief. Dateline Okmulgee, the story said that unlike other Indian leaders who are involved in controversy and scandals, the longtime chief being honored was not. His name was Clark Cox, and he had led the Creek Nation for 20 years. Among his accomplishments listed, the one the article focused on was that he brought Indian gaming to Oklahoma, which was an economic boon for the state. The piece quoted Cox recalling his first days in office. There was me, a desk, and I got an advisory board of 7 people. We ran this place the best we could. When he became chief, the Creek Nation's annual budget was $20,000. When he left 2 decades later, the nation had an operating budget of $13 million and employed 1,000 in 45 facilities in 8 Oklahoma counties. Cox indisputably set the nation on a path of long-term growth. The article reported the Creek Nation status as of 1997. The tribe has a $94 million annual budget, including health, housing, and gaming enterprises, and employs 2,200 people in 80 facilities. Cox's support of gaming made gambling and gaming an economic engine for the Creek and the state of Oklahoma. Oklahoma allowed the Creeks to open a 39-bed hospital in Okemah, build housing projects which now total more than 2,000 units, and institute educational programs. Claude Cox did what no Creek chief had ever done and what other leaders wish they could do, be reelected so often that your political prowess is unquestioned and your legacy secured. Remembering heroes is tricky because readers of history who live in the shadows of history's legacy have to make judgment calls about how much of the bad about these figures we will tolerate in the name of remembering the good. Today, we decry Mount Rushmore not only because it is carved out of the sacred mountain range of the Lakota, but because of the men whose faces are etched into it. President George Washington, who, though he founded this country, also earned the nickname Conotocorius, Town Destroyer, for his uncivil attempts to civilize and solve the so-called Indian problem. Or Theodore Roosevelt, who may have protected wildlife and public lands by creating the U.S. Forest Service and 5 national parks, but who said of the Indian, "I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are the dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of every 10 are." We have these debates about what great men and great women throughout history have done, and we memorialize them, carefully trying to pick out what will and will not be remembered. Because remembering history tells us far more about who we are and who we aspire to be. Remembering Claude Cox, a truly great Cree chief, and both his intentional acts and their unintended consequences tells us a great deal about what the world thinks of Black lives, especially the life of a Black Creek woman with a quiet voice and a loving temperament named Johnny Mae Austin, who just stopped getting her mail. It wasn't only Jake Symonds Sr.'s immediate family that benefited from his success. In addition to his 10 biological children, Jake Sr. helped raise 4 outside kids, some destitute adopted boys and a variety of other relatives, according to Jake Symonds Jr.'s biographer. One of those relatives was Johnny Mae Austin, the daughter of Jake's brother, John. When Johnny Mae was born in 1932 on Creek land, the Creek Nation was going through radical change, change that altered Johnny Mae's chances of claiming Creek citizenship. Her identity as a citizen of the Creek Nation has become intricately tied to the political success of Claude Cox. Austin's identity and her eventual exclusion from the Creek Nation were the collateral damage of Cox's march to make the Creek more independent. One of the truths of American history is that white men have been telling people who are not white men who they are and who they can be. It's why racist policies have persisted, and it's fundamentally why the controversy between the Creek Nation and its former Black citizens still brews. After the Dawes Commission reallocated Native lands, some people had access to good lands, while others, many others, especially those who were Creek citizens, were left with land that was unsuitable either for farming and ranching or for wildcatting. With nearly 100 million acres of the Creek Nation's land taken by the federal government, life got much harder for many Creeks, even if it didn't necessarily for the enterprising work of Jake Symonds, father and son. In 1928, the Rockefeller Foundation funded the Institute for Government Research, also known as IGR, the predecessor to what is now the Brookings Institution, to compile what became an 847-page report about what life was like for American Indians. Named for the erudite bureaucrat and report writer, Lewis Merriam, the Merriam Report revealed the extreme poverty and devastation that Native people lived in, and it explicitly blamed the Dawes Commission, which had repatriated land the U.S. government said it would never touch, and the Curtis Act, which decimated tribal governments. It took nearly 50 years for those in the U.S. government to realize just how bad life had gotten for these nations. The report found that at the time, in 1928, the average life expectancy of an American Indian was 44 years. The average life expectancy of an average American was 55.6 years. The average income for an American household was $1,407. The study found that the average annual per capita income was $100 for America's indigenous population. These facts set down for anyone to see the perilous lives of people in America who are not white. Finally, the U.S. government had to reckon with the devastation it had caused. 6 years after the Merriam Report was released, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Commissioner of Indian Affairs, John Collier, used the report to reverse decades of bad federal policy, but not by consulting the nations and empowering them to set their own course. Instead, the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934 was passed, which allowed Indian tribes throughout the country to establish tribal governments under the pretext that the cultures of these nations had something to teach the non-indigenous population. The fact that the U.S. government had to re-legislate the power for nations to do what any nation should have the right to do was only part of a larger problem. 2 years later, championed by a Democratic senator from Oklahoma, the Oklahoma Indian Welfare Act, also called the OIWA, was passed. The OIWA stopped the allotment and loss of Indian lands and reconstituted tribal governments. On the surface, these changes sound like progress. But often, when you genuinely want to help, you ask those who need help how you can be most effective, That did not happen here. Instead, the U.S. government told the nations that it was creating a governing organization called the Business Committee. This group limited the strength of internal democratic processes that had existed for generations in the Creek Nation. The separation of powers which had existed in the Creek Nation before the United States tore apart its government didn't find its way into the Business Committee structure. The executive, legislative, and judicial functions were all performed by the governing board. Initially, the Creek said no to the OIWA form of governance. Without formal approval, the representatives of the 42 Creek tribal towns, three of which were black tribal towns, elected the nation's first principal chief in more than 30 years. 5 years later, Harold Ickes, President Roosevelt's long-serving Secretary of the Interior, said to Roosevelt that he approved the Creek Convention as a legislative body, which acted like the Creek Council that Cow Tom and Legis Perryman had once known. In 1944, the Creek Nation's General Convention ratified a new constitution that merged the Business Committee's executive and legislative branches into the Creek Indian Council, which would govern the Creek Nation while not deviating too far from the Business Committee structure the OIWA provided. Freedmen, black Creeks, were left out of this vote. Black people like Johnny May. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, also known as the BIA, told the Creek Nation to reconstitute its government structure again. And it wasn't only the BIA that had problems with this. Chief John Davis, who came to power in 1951, rejected both the Creek Indian Council and the constitution this newer council produced. Yet the U.S. government was inconsistent in advancing the independence and autonomy of the Creek. The BIA started to openly favor terminating the Creek's tribal government, removing the principal chief role, and cutting off the chance for Creeks to elect their leaders, the goal being to make the nations more directly adherent to federal control and oversight. On August 1, 1953, the House representatives passed a concurring resolution, House Concurrent Resolution 108, which was a formal statement that, among other things, announced the federal government's termination policy. Some tribes were terminated immediately and made citizens of the United States. But the termination led to the end of aid, protections, and services, and in some cases, reservations. A total of 179 tribes were terminated. But perhaps most perniciously, it called for the Department of the Interior to start finding other tribes for termination quickly. It is why Dr. Dean Chavers wrote in Indian Country Today, "The 1953 termination or Bossone Bill passed under the radar without any consultation with tribes. It was possibly more devastating than the Dawes Act." Remember what Andrew DeBow called American citizenship for the Creek: a perilous gift. If the U.S. government granted all of the rights and prerogatives pertaining to American citizenship, then the promises and treaties that came before would no longer hold. Their citizenship as Americans, unasked for, nullified their native governments, their ways of life. As the 1950s went on, the BIA started refusing Creeks the right to elect a chief. Instead, the BIA appointed the chiefs. The Creek Tribal Council became an advisory committee that could only suggest ideas to the chief and the BIA. It could no longer govern. Since that time, the council has served more as an advisory board than a legislative body. So the Creek tribal government was often filled by BIA appointees. By 1964, trust in the chiefs appointed by the federal government had plunged, even as money started to flow back into the Creek Nation as the United States began to pay small penalties for breaking its numerous treaties. As a result, tribal towns began to take a more prominent role in deciding what would happen in Creek life. While the Creek Nation didn't get full autonomy, the towns within the Creek Nation did. As time went on, recommendations resurfaced, both within and outside the Creek Nation, that they should govern themselves once again, that limiting their opportunities would never result in the success that white men who ran the U.S. government were looking for. On July 8, 1970, President Richard Nixon addressed Congress to provide a special message to Congress on Indian affairs. In his address, he offered a new path forward for self-determination. He said, "This must be the goal of any new national policy toward the Indian people, to strengthen the Indian sense of autonomy without threatening his sense of community. We must assure the Indian that he can assume control of his own life without being separated involuntarily from the tribal group. We must make it clear that Indians can become independent of federal control without being cut off from federal concern and federal support." 185 years after Benjamin Hawkins concluded that there was an Indian problem that needed a white man's solution, it took another president to realize that liberation and so-called help might be the worst solutions for Native people. With this recognition came new legislation that transformed Creek life. The same year as that speech, Congress passed the Principal Chiefs Act, which again allowed the Creek Nation and other nations to elect their own chiefs. Enter Chief Clark Cox, the longest-serving principal chief in the history of the Creek Nation, who spelled the doom to Johnny May's mail. Chief Cox would not have become a leader without the Creek Nation getting its autonomy back. It turned to him in 1971. Before this, Chief Cox worked until he was 57 at the Public Service Company of Oklahoma. According to historian Claudio Sount, Cox went as white before he became chief. Cox was a pole man for the Rural Electric Company, and only white men could get these desirable jobs. After retiring from the company, he ran for chief of the Creeks and won. His task was clear: restore the Creek Nation, establish its system of governance, and generate revenue. In every way, Cox followed through on these three tenets, though not without federal help. In 1975, after Nixon resigned the presidency, Congress passed the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act, following the policy change he had called for 5 years earlier. The act moved the governing from the unilateral control over indigenous programs and services to empowering Indian nations to create and design programs and services that responded to the needs of their people in their nations, a practice that has persisted for more than 40 years. These changes allowed Claude Cox to begin building the foundation for what would become a large gambling revenue stream for the nation, whose revenue established a hospital in Okemah and health and other social services for Creeks. Though the Creek Nation again could elect its own chiefs, for many of its electoral and budgetary decisions, the nation had to ask the federal government for approval. But standing in the way of any political victory is a political contest. Alan Harjo, another Creek leader, desperately wanted to become principal chief of the Creek Nation. He ran against Claude Cox in 1971 and 1975, and a key issue in the election was the National Council. Cox wanted to rewrite the Creek Constitution to allow candidates to come from newly reconstituted districts as opposed to old towns, as they had originally. Harjo wanted to return to the old National Council and Creek representation as it had been laid out in the Constitution that came after the treaty Cowtown signed in 1866. When Cox won re-election in 1975, Harjo challenged in federal district court the legal standing of the U.S. president to formally recognize only the Creek chief, not the Creek National Council. The decision of the U.S. District Court made it clear that tribal governments could administer nearly everything, from housing to law enforcement, education, health, social service, and community development programs. The court had sided with Harjo, and in so doing, it removed whatever shackles the Creek Nation had in governing itself. The decision of the court empowered Cox and his officials to do something the Creek Nation hadn't done in more than 100 years: rewrite and ratify a new constitution. But self-governance did not become equal governance for all Creek, regardless of race. In fact, it killed it. This new Creek constitution instituted something very different from the 1867 constitution. It spelled out Creek citizenship on grounds that it had never been defined as before. Johnny Mae recalled her great-uncle Jake Simmons, whom she called Granddad, as being Creek to the bone. She could recall him singing songs about the Creek Nation being her home. She, like other Black Creeks, grew up knowing that they were Creek. Johnny Mae grew up on Creek land in Oklahoma. Her grandparents taught her jokes and cuss words in Creek. She would travel from Haskell to Muskogee on her great uncle's horse and buggy while Granddad told stories about what it meant to be Creek. The first time I drove to Johnny Mae's home in Tulsa, I got lost trying to find it. But right around the bend of a steep turn, sitting in her walking chair, was Johnny Mae Austin, dressed in sweatpants, a white shirt bedazzled with orange, red, purple, and green beads, and a pair of croc-like shoes. She waved with one hand, and with the other hand, firmly gripped her large metal temperature control cup. She motioned for me to get out of the car and make my way into her home. Within seconds of being inside, I knew I had been transported back to being a young boy, when life looked a lot different for Black people. Johnny Mae's walls were covered with pictures of the schoolhouse she attended, of her great-aunt Rose Simmons, who taught her to read. She pointed to the teacher's licenses of her family who had been teachers and principals of Black Creek schools who were fully Black and fully Creek. She took out portraits of herself and her cousins. She showed me her cousins Don and JJ. She opened drawers and showed me the mail she'd received from the Creek Nation regularly over the years. Some of the letters alerted her to upcoming meetings. Others told her of elections within the Creek Nation. Some letters notified her of per capita payments for the settlement of lands or any money owed to Creeks for the countless offenses and treaty ruptures the U.S. government had committed. Some of those payments were like the one distributed by Commissioner Lewis Bruce in 1972, which paid $4.9 million to the Creek Nation, equivalent to more than $31 million today. For me, her house stood as a true expression of what it means to be fully Black and fully Creek. Shaking her head as she looked at a picture of Jake Sr. and Rose on their land, she said, "He'd be devastated, my grandfather especially devastated." Devastated because Johnny Mae, his granddaughter, no longer has a home in the Creek Nation. Johnny grew up in Haskell, Oklahoma, on Jake Sr.'s 2,000-acre ranch. She recalled how he was all Creek, all the time. Creek to the bone, and so was my grandmother. Yet they weren't Creek enough to pass as Creek, and it wasn't because they didn't have the documents to prove their lineage. No, Johnny Mae's family became too Black to be Creek nearly 30 years before she was born. Beginning in 1902, every Creek family, or those who believed themselves to be part of the nation, had to re-enroll in the nation. In order to enroll, each adult had to appear before a committee, usually of white men, and prove they were who they said they were. Their Creekness had to be validated by white men who had invented rigid categories that weren't consistent with Creek life. You were either freedmen or by blood. Depending on which category a Black family fell into, if you were by blood, you were considered pure Creek, almost untainted by the perceived negative of being Black. If you were freedmen, it meant that you were a descendant of slaves. This was a name given all too often to Black Creeks, even if they were never descended from slaves. Before this time, being freedmen or by blood didn't matter to Black Creeks, because they had always been and would remain Creek, or so they thought. Yet on March 13th, 1902, Jake and Rose Simmons went from being Creek without asterisk, caveat, or exception to being Creek freedmen, a designation that forever tampered with the notion of identity without qualifiers. By becoming freedmen, the Simmons' legacies became inextricably linked with slavery. Traditionally, Creek lineage is matrilineal. So Rose's deep and direct family ties to Creek leadership, such as her grandfather, Cow Tom, a former chief, would have made her a guaranteed Creek on the by-blood roll. As both Johnny Mae and DeMario recalled, Rose Simmons handled all the business of being Creek. When Dawes came, Jake Sr. and the rest of the family could have been put on as a Creek by blood. But when they dealt with Rose, she looked like an African, and it didn't matter then to be Creek or freedman, DeMario told me. He continued, That's how some of these families got split up on the roles. Johnny May said simply and powerfully, "I think the Creek Nation just considered us Black Africans, and that's it." That distinction wouldn't matter, except the Harjo decision empowered Chief Cox to bolster the independence of his nation by diluting the citizenship value of Black Creeks, the very case that entitled Cox and the Creek Nation to experience true autonomy and independence from the United States also gave them the independence they needed to toss out their Black brothers and sisters. As much as Chief Cox should be remembered as the chief whose tireless work ensured a more self-determining future for the Creek, we must consider all that he did over that time. Because of Claude Cox's 20 years as chief, the Creek Nation established the groundwork for becoming a leader in the casino and gambling industries. Jamie Floyd, a past principal chief of the Creek Nation, said in 2019 that the Muscogee Creek Nation is thriving, and that the Creek Nation is undoubtedly an important part of the greater economy. He's right. Gaming revenue in the fourth quarter of 2018 alone came in at more than $25 million. And it goes beyond gaming. An economic impact report by the Creek Nation found that the nation contributes more than $1.4 billion a year to the national economy, accounting for more than 10,000 jobs and paying $443 million in wages and benefits. And its economic impact on Oklahoma in 2017 alone reached $866 million. The nation's compact with the state government of Oklahoma has provided millions in education funding for the broader student population in Oklahoma. Not only did the economic prospects of the Creek improve under Chief Cox, but he also oversaw the return of the Creek Nation to Creek hands. When the court found in favor of the Creek Nation in Harjo versus Kleppe, Cox and his supporters rewrote the Creek Constitution in a way that, in his eyes, reflected the actual concerns of the Creek. And to a great extent, the Constitution did that. Cox's Constitution divided the Creek government into three branches, legislative, executive, and judicial, with a cabinet with departments that oversaw aspects of Creek life. In making the Creek Nation their own again, the Creek started a new chapter in their history of self-determination. At 9:15 a.m. on October 29, 1977, Chief Claude Cox welcomed the members of the council to the quarterly council meeting. After a prayer by Reverend Tony Hill in the native Creek language, the singing of a Creek hymn, and a few words from the Speaker of the House and famed artist Solomon McCombs, the meeting started. Roll was taken by Ann Holder, the recording secretary. After a few preliminaries, Claude Cox cemented the fate of Johnny May and thousands of others like her. "After the selection of the chief, I came in, and we tried to write up a constitution," Cox said. "There was about 25 people who had input on that constitution. We put it together where we thought it was feasible and in the best interest of the Creek Nation to make it a strong Creek Nation." He continued, but more strongly and in a more full-throated fashion. "When you go back to the old constitution, you are licked before you start," Cox said, "because it doesn't talk about Indians. It talks about citizens of the Creek Nation." Cox had done what his many forebears would not do. He bought into the overly simplistic view that race should determine one's access to citizenship. He embraced the notion that the Creek Nation had uniquely rejected decades before, that people couldn't be both Black and Creek. Cox codified this view because, as with his choice to pass as white to get the job at the Public Service Company of Oklahoma, he knew that being white had a currency in America that no measure of hard work by a marginalized person could buy. He used the anti-Indigenous tropes that had been used against his ancestors and leveraged it to separate the Black people who had called the Creek Nation home. As the meeting went on, Cox doubled down on this perspective, which had been created by the white men and the white supremacy that Cox had made a political career of rebuffing. Cox continued, "There were more that was non-Indians or half-blood or less who outnumbered the full-bloods. All of these totaled about 11,000, and there were only 18,000 on the entire roll. so there was only 9,000 above one half blood. That's the reason they lost control. The full blood lost control. That's what we're fighting, this blood quantum, trying to get back and let the people control, because under the old constitution, you've lost before you ever started. As Cox put it, if we want to keep the Indian in control, we've got to take a good look at this thing and get us a constitution that will keep the Creek Indian in control. In an instant, Cox did what the leaders of the Dawes Commission had been begging to do all along. Use the tactics of racism and white supremacy to narrow Creek identity to a matter of race. There was no mention by Cox of the overrunning of Sooners, white men, onto Indian land just a few decades before. According to Dr. Daniel Littlefield of the Sequoia National Resource Center, there are roughly 300,000 poor whites in Indian Territory, many of whom expected that Creek land would be theirs in the lead-up to Oklahoma becoming a state. Many of these whites married into or were adopted by the Creeks and were considered full-blood members. But black people, whose legacy predated these white Sooners, were somehow too black to be Creek. As Littlefield explained it, within Muscogee Creek leadership at the time, there was a strong element of, we are a tribe of Indians. Creek citizenship now had a litmus test. You or your ancestors couldn't be black, or at least noticeably black, when the Dawes Commission was equipping the Creek Nation with notions that blood quantum could be determined by white men. Cox got his way. In 1979, the Creek Nation adopted a new constitution, and in Article 3, Johnny May and thousands of other black Creeks lost their constitutional claim to their identity. Section 4 in Article 3 of the Constitution read, "Full citizenship in the Muscogee Creek Nation shall be those persons and their lineal descendants whose blood quantum is one quarter or more Muscogee Creek Indian, hereinafter referred to as those of full citizenship. All Muscogee Creek Indians by blood who are less than one quarter Muscogee Creek Indian by blood shall be considered citizens and shall have all rights and entitlement as members of the Muscogee Creek Nation, except the right to hold office." Johnny May wasn't on the by blood roll, and with the stroke of a pen, she was no longer Creek. The mail she once treasured, the notifications to vote, the news about the nation, the offers of social, educational, and health services was gone. Johnny May stopped getting mail when she stopped being Creek. As for Cox, he maintained his hold on Creek leadership for almost 11 more years, helping to usher in increased autonomy and self-determination for those Creek by blood. Whether or not he tried, Cox couldn't avoid the allure of white supremacy to determine citizenship in the Creek Nation, and he couldn't avoid taking up the benefits and advantages that passing as white, or at least not being labeled black, can offer. Historian Claudio Sant has written that Creeks would ask their neighbors, "Did you hear who's Estilusti?" which was Creek for black man. What became clear was that answering this question came with embarrassing revelations that became so frequent that Creeks soon began to joke about the subject, Sant wrote. According to Sant, Creeks would rush friends and, as if they possessed a choice piece of gossip, ask with excitement, "Did you hear who's not Estilusti?" Passing as not black became identity currency. Unlike Chief Claude Cox, who passed as not black even though he had traces of African ancestry in his blood, the Simmons family couldn't. These distinctions were arbitrary, and opting in and out of them works only if you're not black. In changing the Creek citizenship parameters to exclude those who are not on the by blood roll, Cox did the unforgivable. Not only did he banish countless black Creeks from Creek membership, but he also exorcised part of himself, his own African ancestry. His nephew, Buddy Cox, stated bluntly to Sant, "We owned some, we were some, and we slept with some." An unnamed female officer of the Creek Nation who knew Buddy and Sant remarked while looking at a picture that they all looked black, but then in relief added, Thank God for Clark slipping that Constitution past. The officer, like Claude Cox, knew that being Black in America, even if in the Creek Nation, was marginalizing. Perhaps to Claude Cox's possible chagrin, his nephew admitted gregariously to Sount, "I'm Estilusti." In other words, he too has African ancestry. The female officer who thanked God for getting the Creek Constitution passed that disenfranchised Black Creeks admitted the same, saying, "My family is part Black too, but I don't show it, do I?" Buddy Cox even rhetorically presented an idea about having African ancestry when he commented, "Don't we all?" In seeming fear of being identified as too Black to be Creek, the officer replied, "Not me." Never before had the delineation between by blood and freedmen affected Creek citizenship or its accompanying rights. But with the 1979 decision to rewrite the Constitution, Chief Cox created a more independent and autonomous Creek Nation, while at the same time making it less Black, ignoring the long legacy of Black progress, and intentionally stamping out future opportunities for Black Creek descendants. As much good as Claude Cox did for the Creek Nation, we must balance that good with the fact that before she died, Johnny Mae Austin never got to reclaim the citizenship she so treasured.